Thank you very much. And thank you to the organizer for inviting me to this splendid location. Excellent science. So I gave this title, and then as it happened, I sort of regretted it. anyway, I would kind of remedy that, I think. So I'm going to talk about frustration, systems with geometrically frustrating lattice, at least for the most part. And we've seen already this morning from Art Ramirez that one of the general effects of frustrations is to suppress ordering transitions. That's kind of a general rule. So the ordering temperature are much suppressed with respect to what you expect from susceptibility. And three outcomes eventually are possible. One is there is a symmetry breaking at some point, so the lattice distorts, the system is no longer frustrated, and then say some kind of a long-range order. A second possibility is, again, we've heard this extensively this morning, that the system freezes in a kind of glass-like state with finite zero temperature entropy. And a classic example, of course, is ice in water. Where this happened, the system loses ergodicity eventually and is trapped in one of the many quasi-equivalent configurations. And then the third and the most intriguing possibility is that you stabilize some kind of, you lose entropy to some kind of quantum state. But that's not completely clear. But we were discussing this morning whether there is any system that actually displays this physics. In any case, what I'm mainly interested in is symmetry breaking. One of the reasons that might be interesting is that, of course, you get coupled degrees of freedom. Whatever degrees of freedom you're trying to order on the lattice couple strongly to the lattice because you break the symmetry, and therefore you might have some functionality. But again, in this audience, it's probably not all that interesting. But there are other aspects of interest, and particularly what happens near the Mott transitions, which is the title. So when the system goes from highly localized to highly metallic, are these ordering modes changed in the various sectors, charge orbitals, etc.? So I'm going to present a number of systems which have interesting phenomenology, some that are truly frustrated and some others which are just competitive, and we'll explore some of the consequences. These are the systems I'm going to describe. First couple have to do with unusual ways to relieve orbital and magnetic degeneracy on triangular lattices. I'm going to talk about silver nickel oxide and sodium manganese oxide. I'm then going to talk about a system that displays magnetoelastic effects, distinguishing between systems with competing interaction and truly frustrated system where you have exact cancellations. And these are the systems I'm going to describe. And finally, through my introduction of bismuth manganese oxide, I will go on to move on mechanism of multiferroicity and possibly functionality, God forbid. So this slide is to just acknowledge collaboration and references. The work on silver nickel oxide really is the principal author is Radu Kolder and his student Eva Warzinska. I, of course, acknowledge collaboration. I'm only citing the principal collaborators because otherwise I'll have various pages here. Igor and Michelle, another research lab for some of the calculations. And then this work on alpha sodium manganate is by my postdoc, Maud Giot, Laurent Chapon at ISIS, Alex Lappas, who actually initiated this project in Greece. The paper is in the state of being submitted. bismuth manganese also is with Gianluca Calestani and his student and in Parma, and it's already published. This work has been published a couple of years ago on Vomo. And finally, the multiferroicity. There are various references. The paper I'm actually going to refer to and describe in more detail is actually submitted right now. Okay, so silver nickel oxide. I'll start with that because I think it's a very interesting system. It's a system with a triangular lattice, which it has in fact a hexagonal structure. So the triangular nickel oxide is stacked upon on top of each other, and like some of most of the other systems have a rhombohedral structure. In fact, there is a variant of the same compound which has a rhombohedral structure. Other characteristic of silver nickel oxide is that, unlike many other isostructural systems, it is rather metallic, although it's a poor metal. And we'll see that the consequences of this are really quite intriguing. So nickel 3 plus should be in this electronic configuration, low spin, 3D7, and therefore it should be a Jahn-Teller ion. If we study the spin half, if you study the susceptibility of this system, you'll notice that indeed the order in temperature is quite suppressed. The theta is about minus 100, but it doesn't order until about 20 Kelvin, and it has a sharp anomaly indicating that it becomes long-range ordered magnetically. These are the kind of neutron data, and from these neutron data we did refine a structure which is actually quite unusual. It consists of chains, ferromagnetically coupled chains, which are then coupled among themselves antiferromagnetically in this direction, and then the stacking is like that. But there is only one out of three sites that is magnetically ordered. Okay, so two sites don't carry any sizable magnetic moment. Only one has a fairly large magnetic moment. We actually started looking for some kind of underlying superstructure, and we found it. This is the magnetic propagation vector 16160, whereas there is an additional propagation vector 1/3, 1/3 in the plane, which is already present, in fact, at room temperature. So there is a superstructure occurring at room temperature, and in fact we can see nicely the disappearance of those superlattice peaks about 360 Kelvin. Okay, so the system has already a superstructure at room temperature, and then upon cooling it becomes magnetic. And in fact, it turns out that we can refine the crystal structure of this based on these superlattice reflection and on very good quality neutron data. In fact, most of the displacement, essentially all the superlattice peak result from oxygen displacements, because the X-ray in the Rex data you see don't see anything. So you can refine this crystal structure on the basis of three different nickel sites, and there is a perfect consistency between those three different nickel sites and the way they are stacked in the unit cell and the way the magnetic structure is stacked. So these nickel sites, two of these nickel sites are surrounded by oxygen, which breathe in. Okay, so they are smaller sites, and one is a larger site. So the interpretation of this is that essentially the larger size becomes nickel 2 plus instead of 3 plus, and those extra electrons are taken away from the smaller site, which are on average 3.5 plus. So they don't carry any. Again, the band structure calculation, the LDA calculation, in fact confirm this picture and indicate that the rather itinerant character of these two nickel sites, whereas the nickel 1 site is highly localized. So we have this very unusual situation in which you have essentially localized sites, you have a charge disproportionation and one localized site and two sites. So you have a metal and an insulator basically coexisting within the same crystal structure. And then you go back to your question, why does the system choose to have this unusual disproportionation rather than doing a Jahn-Teller distortion as all Christian nickel 2, 3 plus should do? And the question is, you can gain, and again the calculation indicated that gain is mainly in the Hund rule coupling. But why would the system choose to lose Coulomb energy in favor of this one? And the answer is that because the system is so delocalized, it can screen the Coulomb energy and therefore doesn't lose so much energy. So that's actually a very interesting situation because in these compounds you can go within this essentially similar structure type, although I'm not quite sure about the hexagonal type, but essentially within the same layered structure from very localized systems like the sodium nickelate, which is Jahn-Teller, to this system, which is delocalized and has this very unusual disproportionation, to an intermediate state, which is the lithium, which maybe Takashi will tell us something about, which perhaps is Jahn-Teller but does something different, okay? Local Jahn-Teller. But you have this very nice series. Okay. Now, the normal situation as I said, is is that of the Jahn-Teller distortion, and that's certainly what, for example, sodium nickel oxide decides to do. This is the rhombohedral version in which the layers are not stacked on top of each other but staggered. Okay, so the question in sodium nickel oxide, you have indeed a Jahn-Teller distortion, so you have these octahedra that all elongate. It's a ferroorbital ordering situation in which all the octahedra are elongated along the same direction. So you go from rhombohedral to monoclinic, and then you get ferromagnetic ordering because you have essentially edge-sharing octahedra, and with 90-degree bonds you get weak ferromagnetic ordering. Now, an interesting situation realizes itself if you replace the nickel with manganese. So you have sodium manganese oxide, same structure type. It's also same unpaired electron in the EG orbitals, but now you have three. So it has high spin manganese 3+, has three electrons pointing in the same direction in a half-filled T2G. So although it's still weakly ferromagnetically interacting through the oxygen, you have now the possibility of a direct exchange interaction between the manganeses. And this is actually what we find. So we find that sodium manganese oxide, as you see, this is the realization of the triangular lattice here. So you have ferroorbital ordering of the manganeses, but now the interactions in all directions are actually antiferromagnetic. So the system, now it has relieved its orbital frustration, but it's still magnetically frustrated because you have, in fact, very strong interaction J1, so you tend to have antiferromagnetic chains in this direction, but then J2, no matter what you decided to do, you get frustration here. Okay? So the system has to now find another way to relieve the magnetic frustration. And in fact, what it does, I don't dwell on this system too much because I have a poster somebody is interested in more detail, is that, what you see is that there's a signature in susceptibility of something happening at rather high temperature, so the system is probably two-dimensionally ordered up to high temperature, but it's only about 20 low temperature, 50 Kelvin, where it actually becomes magnetically ordered, and you can see that magnetic ordering is accompanied by a structural distortion. So that structural distortion from monoclinic to triclinic further relieves the frustration by making these two bond lengths here in red different. Okay, so now the system can choose one way of ordering as opposed to the other. It's interesting to notice that, in fact, at high temperature, where we've seen this signature effect magnetic ordering, there is also a lot of magnetic diffuse scattering, but also there is a very significant lattice strain. Okay, so it's likely that locally the system relieves this frustration already at rather high temperature, although it's not long-range order in three dimensions. Okay, so these two systems I've talked about, the Lafosite systems, in the general exception, provided us with a tool to explore various situations of frustration, both in the orbital and in the magnetic sector, and to see what happens when we go from localized to delocalized. Now, this is another interesting model, and the J1, J2 model on the square lattice, and one, again, that we can find compounds to explore various regions of this system. And I want to say a few words about this because through these compounds, I can sort of explain the difference between a situation where you have simply competition between different interactions and a situation where you would want actually to break the symmetry. So here we're talking about the classic J1, J2 model on a square lattice. The model has two extreme points, which are for J2 is equal to zero, so the next neighbor interaction you have a simple ferromagnet, so you have an AL state here at J2 over J1 equals to zero. And in the opposite case, so when J1 is zero and J2 is something, you get two interpenetrating sublattices, which are decoupled. And so you have two antiferromagnetic sublattices, and you can have any angle between the two. However, it turns out that by the order-by-disorder mechanism, you actually stabilize a collinear phase. Now, the difference between these two is the following, that in the L state, which is this state here, you have satisfied all the near-neighbor interactions, but the next near-neighbor interaction are uniformly violated. Okay, so this would like to be Pharaoh, anti-Pharaoh is actually Pharaoh. Okay. However, in the collinear state, which is the one that is stable at large J2, you have only half of the next, so you have all the next near-neighbor interactions that are satisfied, but only half of the near-neighbor interactions that are not satisfied. So that would like to be anti-Pharaoh, and it is anti-Pharaoh, whereas this one is Pharaoh. Okay. So here you have the potential built in to break the symmetry somehow, to make this orthorhombic from being tetragonal, and therefore to relieve the frustration that way. Now, obviously, the most interesting part of the phase diagram is this one in the middle. At 0.5, you have an exact frustrated point, and it's not exactly clear what happens at that point. You know, there you have some kind of exotic ground state. But we haven't found a system where that is. We can realize that. Probably systems try to shy away from being in that situation. But these two systems, lithium VO SiO4 and vanadium MOO5, are realizations of this model, quite good realization of that model. They're quite two-dimensional compounds, but they are in opposite, as you see, opposite side of the phase diagram. The difference is that, of course, in the lithium case, you've got lithium in between these sheets. These sheets are pyramids, VIO4 pyramids. So it's a spin half vanadium 4+ system, and you can see the lithium case is in the it's in the collinear state. So you have these collinear chains that are coupled antiferromagnetic across this direction, so propagation vector half zero, and whereas the molybdenum case it has propagation vector k equals to zero. And you can see very much from our data, it has a reduced moment. It should be one Bohr magnitude. It's actually 0.4. That's partially due to the fact that it's a two-dimensional system. Really, what I want, so this is the classical nail antiferromagnet. What I wanted to emphasize here is the fact that, in spite of the fact that the system there's no way the system can break the symmetry. All the interactions here, as I said, are uniformly wrong. Still, there is a significant magnetoelastic coupling here. And you can see that here happening, in fact, quite well above the transition, where there is an anomaly in the A-axis, whereas some of the bond lengths also change, but nowhere near the transition. So the reason why the system would choose to do that is probably, again, to try and optimize J2, which is the one that has the wrong sign. So it distorts the structure in order to reduce J2 and probably tries to go away from the frustration point, more towards the limit of J2 equals to zero. Another system that has related phenomenology is bismuth manganate. Now, this system has attracted considerable attention because it was purported to be a ferroelectric. In fact, we don't believe that it is. We can refine we're not the first to point this out, but we also agree that the system can be perfectly well refined as a centrosymmetric space group at all temperatures. What I wanted to emphasize here is the rather unusual orbital ordering pattern of this compound. It's isoelectronic to lanthanum manganate, but the fact that you have bismuth here, the lone pair of bismuth, kind of disturbs the arrangement of these channels, and that results in a alteration of the pattern. So these regions here that I marked red in the crystal structure are exactly the same as in lanthanum manganate. However, these light blue octahedra, actually the long bond points out of the sheet. Okay, so whereas all the long bonds here are in the plane, like in lanthanum manganate, these blue light blue octahedra have the long bonds pointing outside. Now you can see within the red sections, the interaction are uniformly ferromagnetic in the plane, as in lanthanum manganate, and uniformly antiferromagnetic outside of the plane. However, these other octahedra realize a ferromagnetic coupling out of the plane, and a mixed coupling in the plane. So these chains are still ferromagnetic, so long strong, etc. Whereas these other chains, this would like to be antiferromagnetic. Okay, so there is competition in magnetic competition in the structure. And we'll see in a second how the system decides to relieve that competition at the magnetic transition. So what we have seen here at the magnetic transition, there is significant magnetoelastic coupling. You can see particularly in the beta monoclinic beta angle, there's a significant deviation from the high temperature behavior. And this is the anomalous part of the strain, if you want, so the part that, by subtracting the high temperature behavior, projected on the pseudo-cubic cell, which is this one, okay, as is in this presentation. So this direction here corresponds to the B direction here. As you see, there is a shrinkage of the lattice constant in that direction, which is the unfrustrated direction. Here, all the interaction I use uniformly ferromagnetic. Okay? Whereas the other two directions where you have competition between ferromagnetism and antiferromagnetism are expanded. Okay? Now, the system overall is a ferromagnet, okay? Because although there are both ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic interactions, the ferromagnetic wins. So there's nothing mysterious about the ferromagnetic. 10 minutes, that's good. I've got the last system to talk about. There's nothing mysterious about an ferromagnetic insulator here. And I presume the mechanism of stabilization of ferromagnetic insulator is similar here as in the doped, lightly doped manganites. Now, the last part is on multifroids, and I'm not going to make a long discussion about it. We've heard a little bit about of course, manganese perovskites this morning from John, and the way the ferromagnetic interaction in the planes is destabilized. Of course, you need, in order to stabilize this, the E-type phase and also the other spiral phase that you find at these light dopings, you also need next near neighbor interactions, which you have in this system. And these this competition gives rise to an interesting phenomenology, which in the perovskites and in other systems is widely interpreted as, so this is the stabilization of the spirals in terms of near-neighbor and next-near-neighbor interactions. So the phenomenology that is the appearance of ferroelectricity below the magnetic below the orient temperature of this particular phase is interpreted in terms of spin orbit coupling. So you have essentially pre-existing spiral cycloidal structure, to be precise, that is imposed by the competition between the magnetic interaction, and the system optimizes its spin orbit energy by displacing the counter ions or the anions, and therefore inducing an overall polarization. What I want to point out here is the nature of the ferroelectric domains in these materials. So the two directions of the polarization, plus and minuses, are associated with what we can call clockwise or anti-clockwise domains, although there is no true chirality in the system. They're just clockwise or anti-clockwise if we see them from this direction, because from the other direction, they would be clockwise and anti-clockwise the other way. There's no chirality in the system. But if you look at them this way, they would rotate in one sense or in the other sense. And what I want to point out here is the fact that the two domains are simply distinguished by one of the components. So from going to here, I simply switch the components in this direction of the magnetic moment. So if I switch, let's say, the component along this direction, I go to here, and the same here. So to go from one domain to the other, it is sufficient for me to switch one of the components that contributes to the cycloid. Okay? And this is what I would expect the system to do when I reverse the polarization. Now, if dipole moments are already present, I have potentially another mechanism other than the vector coupling that is associated with spin orbit energy. I could have a scalar coupling or a magneto exchange restriction coupling, which simply have to do with modulating a pre-existing dipole moment. For example, if I had two ions with different charges, I could change their distance depending on whether the coupling is ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic. Okay? And that would change the size of the dipole moment. And the same thing I can do, in fact, by changing the bond angles, going from ferromagnetic to antiferromagnetic coupling. So that mechanism is also available, but this mechanism is, in order to get an overall polarization from a system that has a center of inversion, I have to have frustration, and this I'll illustrate in the next slide. Okay. So let's say that I have a central symmetry here, and I have a configuration like that, and the central symmetry brings me to a configuration like that, all the dipole moment would cancel. Okay. Whereas, in order to have a net polarization, I would have to have two bonds related by central symmetry that carry opposite magnetic configuration. So this one ferro and this one anti-ferro. Okay. In this case, I would get a polarization that is different from zero. Now, because I don't have much time, I'll just go quickly over the illustration of this system, the 125 system, where we do believe we are in exactly this situation. And this is the behavior of the polarization as a function of temperature and applied field to just see the degree of control that we can realize. So the crystal structure is more complex than in the case of the perovskite, but the important point that I want to emphasize is the presence of these fivefold rings in the structure. And the fivefold rings, in the presence of complete antiferromagnetic interactions, generate a frustrated geometry, whereby if I start with, say, a plus configuration and I go around the ring, I find myself with a clash. And in fact, the magnetic structure that is realized in practice has bonds that are equivalent by central symmetry, like, for example, this configuration, this configuration and this configuration that carry opposite magnetic configuration. So this is ferro and this is antiferro, these two being related by inversion. Okay? So we would expect, as in the other system, that the system wants to relieve this exact cancellations by doing that, by symmetry, we can show that we can generate a polar moment. Now, these are the expected polarization domains in the two cases. And we can see here they're quite different from the previous case. So what is switched here is the majority component of the domain. So if there is any spiral component perpendicular to it, it may or may not switch as well. But the important thing is that for this mechanism to be valid, we should observe a switching of the largest component of the spins that are associated with this mechanism. And we recently done that experiment. It's used by using Newton's spherical polarimetry. In Newton's spherical polarimetry, we can illustrate it. We can prepare the spin in any direction, or indeed have an unpolarized beam, and analyze the polarization of the outgoing beam in all its components. And this is the way it works. Just to simplify things, I start with an unpolarized beam, and one of the two domains here would generate a polarization of the outgoing neutron in one direction, whereas the opposite domain would generate a polarization in the other direction. Okay? I can also prepare the polarization in all other direction, and thereby confirming the magnetic structure of each domain. Now, when we do the experiments, we prepare the crystal with electrodes and apply an electric field, and we can therefore... magnetic scattering. So this is the experiment that was done by electric field cooling down to 25K in two different field directions. And the relevant polarization directions that I was telling you about that distinguish the two domains are these, the YX and ZX. And you can see they switch sign by changing the electric field, whereas all the other components remain the same because they are not sensitive to the domain structure. Okay. The calculated value for 100% polarization is the boxes, and the measured value is the red. Okay. And these are different magnetic Bragg peaks that have been measured and all confirm this 100% polarized domain structure. We can do something more, and this is my last slide. We can actually go closer to this transition and drive the system by applying a field, an electric field. So before I was cooling in a field and measuring at a low temperature and I get 100% polarization. But if I get close enough to the transition, I start from one of these states, warm close to the transition, and then I can go around a hysteresis loop. So this is the component of the polarization, the YX component of polarization that is proportional to the domain population, and this is a function of the applied voltage, and I can go around a hysteresis loop. Now, the hysteresis loop is skewed. It's not centered because it's biased by the pre-existing polarization of the system. But we can show by bulk measurements of the polarization that the value of the hysteresis loop and its displacement are consistent with those measurements. So what we have shown here is that, indeed, we can switch by... So the A component, which is the one that you would expect to switch if you believe the exchange friction mechanism, does in fact switch, and it is coupled to the electrical polarization. And I conclude here.
Okay. In silver nickel O2, you have magnetic sites and conducting sites. The magnetic sites, did I understand correctly that they are arranged to form a triangular lattice?
Yeah, they also arrange to form a triangular
and
lattice.
And so do you have any idea why you don't get the regular 120
yes.
degree ordering?
Well, it's a combination of anisotropy and also a moderate degree of next near neighbor interaction. So the two things stabilize a collinear structure versus the 120
okay. And then do you have an extra breaking of a symmetry there? You break a threefold symmetry at the transition?
There should be, because this direction, in fact, is no longer equivalent to the other two. Yeah. But we couldn't observe that.
You haven't observed.
Remember what my question was. Yes. You were concerned about the amount of electrostatic energy. You talked about a lot of screening and you wave hand screening, which is what the theorists like to do. But I just call attention to the fact of what Zabotsky and his friends said many years ago, that essentially you have a charge gap with nickel 2 plus, and so the nickel 3 plus, nickel 2 plus, and the nickel 4 plus, nickel 3 plus couples are pinned at the top of the oxygen 2 p band. And therefore, if you take and extract lithium from a nickel manganese system, you'll find that when you go from one redox couple to the other, there's no step in the voltage when you go across from nickel 3, nickel 2 to nickel 4, nickel 3. So indeed, it's because of the strong oxygen 2p character in those things that the U parameter or the electrostatic term is very small. You can call it screening if you like, but a simple way to think about it is along those lines.
Over the
oxygen.
But obviously, you know, in the nickel system, you can go from one, like the sodium nickelate is localized the antenna.
That's right. So but with the lithium, you go put a few holes in and it becomes metallic. Okay. So you're obviously at the transition temperature where, when you go through the so-called localized to itinerant behavior, you always get separation into localized and itinerant character. So that fits also into your story.
I understand that in the Mn2O5 compounds, the rare earth moments play an important role in the generation of the phase diagram, but
yes.
I didn't see this in your discussion yet.
Yes, because this is done on yttrium. This experiment was done on yttrium. And it was done on the commensurate phase, particularly, which is the ferroelectric phase. I mean, I think we are trying to study both the incommensurate phase and the rare earth, magnetic rare earth phase, but it's more complicated.
Yeah, you have concluded that two cases, one to produce a magnetic ferroelectricity, one is a vector product and the other is a scalar product. And of course, the former is related to the spin orbit interaction. So I think in the case of the rare earth manganese O3 with the perovskite structure, the former process is relevant. But how about, maybe I missed your conclusion, how about the origin of the ferroelectricity in the yttrium manganese 205?
Yes. So now the discussion, of course, because there is yttrium magnetics 205, the in-plane structure. So if you just take, regardless of the direction of the moments, if you just take a simple collinear structure, that is observed, that would be sufficient to break the symmetry,
yes,
and bring you to a polar phase. However, the existence of an out-of-phase C-axis component has also been observed. And the question is, which one is relevant, or maybe both are relevant. Okay. So there is a sort of a spiral component in perpendicular to this axis. So what we believe is that if that was the only driving force and there was no coupling with the A component, which is the largest component. The largest component is about 2 Bohr magnetons, and the small component are about 0.4 or 0.3 Bohr magnetons. So the product S1 times S2 or S1 vector S2, there's almost to order of factor of 40 difference. Okay. So first of all, there's a very large difference between the two. And also, if there was no coupling at all with the A component, by applying the field, we would not observe switching of the A component, whereas we do. We do necessarily. So the A component is coupled to the polarization. Mm-hmm. And there's no easy way to couple it other than through the displacements. So we believe that this is the primary driving force. Now, the interesting question is whether clearly the spiral component also helps. But maybe one question that I was asking myself is perhaps it's actually driven by the majority component through the inverse method. Okay. So the driving force is the direct exchange coupling, scalar coupling, and the other one is simply by Jaluzinski Maria.
So the major driving force is
This is what we believe. This is what we believe based on our. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I didn't quite understand why the coupling in sodium manganese oxide is interferomagnetic.
Well,
still 90 degree.
What we wrote in the paper is that yes, it is still 90 degrees. So the super exchange is ferromagnetic. Now, the difference between nickel and manganese is that the T2G shells are half empty or half full in manganese, and they are completely full in nickel. So you have now possibility of coupling through those T2G. Now, what we wrote in the paper is that it is by direct exchange, manganese, because they are edge sharing. Okay, maybe there are other possibilities. I mean, maybe there is some kind of pi bonding or some other mechanism.
There is much more measure of stability in the oxygen and
the
heat.
Okay.
That's much more important problem than the actual for the
look at the magnitude of more interacting with this element.
TE, that's what he's talking about. TE.
Yeah.
But the fact is that experimentally the structure is antiferromagnetic. So I think there's no question about it.
Just to follow a little bit about this question that you answered about 120 degree structure,
yes,
in silverite. It's actually a very good question. I will speak about this compound a little bit more on Friday. And of maybe 5 or 6 oddities about this material, this is the one which I have most problem with. Because we did calculation of on-site magnetocrystalline isotropy, and it does come out very, very small, as you would expect. From the fact that it's EG state. And it's my personal feeling, which I cannot really justify, is that this has more to do with interplanar interactions, which appear to be important in this compound, than with any local anisotropy. But again, I mean, we'll probably speak a little bit more about that on Friday.
Any more? Okay, well, we're
nicely on time. So we'll go to the last talk.
Thank you. Yeah.